Workforce Development for Friday or Wednesday evening. Thanks, members, for hanging around. Again, we will not be meeting tomorrow, so that's the good news. I don't know what time we'll get out, but I can tell you we'll be out no later, again, than 6:30. That's will be our cutoff time. If we don't get our work done before then, we'll carry things over. We were expecting Senator Johnson. She isn't here at the moment, but if she comes up, we'll bring her up. But let's open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 807. Janet.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate Bill 807 directs the Economic and Community Development Department to establish a program allowing rural airports to create airport tax increment financing districts with the approval of local taxing jurisdictions, including cities, counties, or special districts. Would specify that in such a district, up to 50% of incremental tax revenues generated by commercial and industrial development can be used for airport infrastructure and services for up to 25 years. The department is required to report to the next legislature on the effects of the new program. Mr. Chair, this bill does have a subsequent referral to finance and revenue. And it's my understanding that it would, by the definitions, it would affect, would be able to be used at rural airports. The definition of a rural airport in current statute is serving a city with a population of 75,000 or fewer. And also, it looks like it applies to public or privately owned, but all public use airports.
Thank you.
Can I ask Janet a question?
Yes.
Do you know how long ago that definition for rural airport was put in the statute?
No, Mr. Chair, I don't.
Because I know that I bet when it was put in statute, Hillsborough Airport would qualify. I know that now that it does not.
Maybe so.
Yeah.
Maybe, some of our guests will know. Well, in fact, just as I was ready to jump ahead, we have been graced by the presence of the queen of all legislators. I'm learning from Courtney now. Buttering her up so we can find out where we want to stick the knife. Senator Betsy Johnson.
Lead up like that. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, can I bring up reinforcements with?
Absolutely. We're on Senate Bill 807, and we were just getting ready to invite Andy and Aaron up, so.
Perfect.
Oh, but before you begin, and after you identify yourself for the record, Senator Starr has a question, and because of your vast background, we're going to see if you know the answer. So please introduce yourself for the record, and Senator Starr has a question, then we'll proceed with Senate Bill 807.
Oh, good, so I can be humiliated on the record if your introduction wasn't.
Oh, I do know.
Good evening, Mr. Chairman, and distinguished members of this August panel. I am Betsy Johnson, state senator for District 16.
Senator Starr.
Thank you. I just commented to our staff about the definition of rural airport that was in ORS 836640 that defined rural airport as serving a city that was less than 75,000 in population. And I remember that we had this through the fence conversation last session, and I didn't know if that definition was incorporated only in the 2005 legislative session or not. But the city of Hillsborough, for instance, is just above that 75,000, well, within 3,000 or 4,000 of that. But when that definition was cast into statute, was it intentional to exclude the city of Hillsborough or the Hillsborough Airport?
Mr. Chair, Senator Starr, quite the contrary. In the discussion of Senate Bill 680, Hillsborough was excluded specifically because they didn't want to participate. Nor in my understanding of how the FAA works should they have participated. Senate Bill 680 was all about trying to figure out how to use private land adjacent to an airport and allow capital investment there for the benefit of the airport. Hillsborough is such a fast-growing airport and such an important executive airport. All the land is owned by the Port of Portland. It is FAA doctrine that they don't like through the fence. So Hillsborough was never contemplated to be part of 680. I don't think wanted to be part of 680. Shouldn't have been part of 680. Would jeopardize their FAA money if they were part of 680. The FAA didn't like 680. And so there was no attempt to do anything to Hillsborough. Hillsborough, however, under this bill, and if we have to adjust the population to make sure Hillsborough could participate, Hillsborough might be ripe for participation in 807. Both 680 and 807 were not airport-specific at all. 680 was a voluntary program with the exception of naming Aurora, which is a unique situation where the primary asset at Aurora is owned by the state and all the dirt is owned by private people. But there is, other than Aurora being named specifically in 680 from last session, neither one of those bills was specific. It's a voluntary program.
But I want to
make sure, given the growth and the dynamism at Hillsborough, that if they want to be included, they could.
Yeah, I'm not sure that they would, and I appreciate the explanation. Thank you.
Hillsborough's a big deal airport, and if you could unring the bell about Hillsborough, because I used to fly there. In fact, I started my company there. If you could unring the bell at Hillsborough, it would have been to have done different land use planning around the airport so as to protect the viability and the possibility for expansion there.
Yep.
Thank you. Okay, let's proceed with 807.
All right. I'm going to leave most of the technical explanation to 807 to my good friend of many years' duration and colleague, Aaron Fagery, and allow him to introduce himself and explain why it is that he can opine on this bill. I was the portal of entry for the Oregon Aviation Business Association to bring this bill to the consideration of the legislature. And at the highest level of sort of Cliff Notes version of the bill, this is offered as just one more tool in the toolbox for airports to develop, specifically rural airports. In many instances, we find ourselves, like John Day, with rural airports that are blessed with a great deal of land, but not a lot of tools to encourage private capital or development there. And you have a scenario where an airport sponsor, in the nomenclature of my industry, that's the person that owns the airport, has raw land, but no tools to develop. And we're trying to make the case that Oregon's system of airports and the land that surrounds them is one of the economic drivers in the state. And we would like to foster both commercial development in and out of more airports to help link the state as a transportation system. And we would like to see airports generate the kind of generally high-tech, generally clean, generally cutting-edge, innovative jobs that we are seeing develop at some airports now. Aurora has had a huge influx of private capital into that airport, and they are providing infrastructure for businesses that are bringing jobs. Some of these businesses are doing extremely cutting-edge, nationally, if not internationally, recognized work. And what's unique to the airport is that many of the companies need a runway. And so we're just trying to figure out how do we maximize development possibilities at Oregon's system of airports, and we offered this bill for your consideration as one of the tools. And with that, I'm going to excuse myself and leave the technical explanation to Mr. Fagery, who helped develop the framework, but I'd be happy to answer any mushball questions before I leave.
Any mushball questions for the Senator? Thank you, Senator, for taking the time to come in.
Cool. And with that, I'll excuse myself, and you can save all the toughies for Mr. Fagery. It's a pleasure to see you, Aaron.
Oh, yeah. Hold on. One other question. Sorry, Senator. Janet Atkins is asking, are we expecting some other amendments to this bill, 807?
I have to actually ask my reinforcements because we have been struggling getting amendments from Legislative Council, and I don't know the status.
I think we can.
We are expecting additional amendments.
Okay. Okay. So they can probably address that.
Yeah, I'm sorry that I'm not completely up to speed.
It's okay.
Getting amendments out of Legislative Council, as you all know, has been somewhat challenging.
Thank you very much, Senator.
Thank you.
Welcome. My name is Aaron Fagery. I'm an architect and civil engineer and run a small design company out of Portland. I've worked on approximately 40 airports around the state. Both for the state of Oregon and for private developers. And in those travels, I've been fortunate to see a lot of aviation businesses, a lot of airports, and to kind of perceive that we're generally underusing the property that's out there at our airports. And Aurora became a place where I could see the potential for how really airports all over the state in this kind of global economy where we've got internet and an airplane, they can become centers for more than just the landing and takeoff of an airplane. That led our interest to the Senate Bill 680, which tried to push that forward a bit. And this bill attempts to continue that and to say why can't these airports be used as economic development centers for jobs, for tax base? If it's on a private, if it's on private land, it becomes tax base to support education and government, fire and so forth. In my travels and involvement with FAA and some other states, I learned that the state of Utah has a bill like this, and it's functioning. And I was asked to actually to help a little bit with some work over there. In their case, their bill actually refunds money from, I believe, income tax, property tax, and income tax and sales tax. So they rebate portions of that to airports for the creation of jobs. And I just have driven down from an airport conference held by the FAA in Seattle, and I learned that Colorado has one as well. In both those cases, the rebates go back to developers specifically. My own opinion was that in the state of Oregon, we would want any sort of rebate like this to go back to the public sector. So this bill is written so that those funds would go only back to infrastructure at the airport, which kind of bootstraps and intends then to allow additional aviation-related development that, again, serves the community. One oddity that I have to explain is that the FAA's rules about the use of airport are so strict that a company which makes aircraft is not considered as an allowed use at an airport. They have very strict rules where they essentially try to narrow things down to only the landing and takeoff of an airplane. Yet, in our culture, we have many people who run companies and things that are associated with aviation who would like to be at the airport. An example is Sky Research down in Ashland, which has brought in many PhDs and has an amazing research program on finding unexploded ordnance and using the aircraft as the tool. These are the kind of companies that we want to see allowed at airports and within a district like this where we're bringing jobs and really first-rate companies and opportunities to the state. So that's our goal as an overview.
Mr. Oxley, you want to comment on anything?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, Gary Oxley, Oxley & Associates, appearing before you this afternoon on behalf of the Oregon Aviation Business Association. To your question, Mr. Chairman, there are amendments, as the Senator pointed out. We are still waiting to receive those from Legislative Council. If the Chair and the committee are comfortable with this bill, we would ask that it be moved, as it has a referral on it, to Finance and Revenue, and upon receipt of our amendments, we can make those changes in that committee.
Okay, good. Is Andy Anderson here? Because he didn't come up. Oh, come on up. You guys can just stay there if you'd like.
Can I ask a question?
Yes, please, Senator Marks.
So this is a property tax. Is that right? Would that be?
Yes, a partial rebate.
And I noticed that it was a blank for what radius. How would that be determined? Who would determine?
Well, that's one of the amendments. And what I've proposed to Legislative Council, and this sounds enormous, but 10 miles, the only reason for a large number is that there could be a rural airport that, for example, wants to tie its airport activity to a resort or to some recreational activity that's close enough that there could be a shuttle bus or something. And so they might find a way that they could develop something like that, and so I just wanted to give flexibility. And my own opinion is that it would be very unlikely that the district would get more than a mile from the airport. It's going to generally be things very close into the airport.
And follow up?
Yes.
And how does Measure 5 and what it has done to the taxing, how would this affect the amount of tax, you know, there's so much tax that we can have, and so I'm wondering how that will fit it all.
Just like any tax increment financing district, this would reduce the amount of taxes, but it would freeze. You would look at the number at the tax revenue at the time that the district was created, and then what this says is then as it increases, you split that. Half goes back to the airport to support this continued development, and half continues on to its intended normal taxing agency. And part of where this comes from is we've seen at Aurora that we've been able to, that airport now generates something on the order of $400,000 to $450,000 per year of taxes for Marion County and for the school district. And we've kind of done a pie chart showing its contribution. And part of that has come because of the development that occurs. And so it's kind of a way of often the airport development is limited by its own infrastructure, and therefore it can't go any further unless it finds a way to kind of bootstrap itself up. So it's intended as a way to allow the airport to develop, and then the airport itself gets some reward back to help it in its mission. But only half, as opposed to a typical tax increment district where all of it goes back to the district.
Okay, just a further question. So really then the city or the county will be getting some of that money, and you're saying half of it then would go to the airport?
What I put in the bill, first of all, the only district that would be created, it would have to be with the agreement of the county. So right from the start, this doesn't even happen unless county commissioners or city commissioners who are in that district said that they wanted it to happen and they could see a benefit from it. And what this bill says is the most it could be is 50%, but it could be less than this.
Okay. Just another follow-up. Well, first of all, say hello to your wife for me.
I will. Thank you, Senator.
She and I work together as public health nurses. So I'm just quite confused regarding, like, if special districts were in the 10-mile radius. I don't know enough about how special districts are taxed. That would be outside and different treated.
I first have to say I'm an architect and an engineer, not a tax specialist or even a very knowledgeable about legislative process. So I apologize for any naivete that I bring here. My own intent, or I think our intent as an organization, was probably not to affect those special districts in any way. We have talked today with the special district executive and lobbyist. For the moment, we don't seem to have any conflict, but our intent wasn't probably to reach into that at all.
Senator Mars, I think Senator Starr has a comment on that.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator, on page 2, line 3, subsection 4 of section 2, says, with the approval of the commission, which is the OECD commission, and of cities, counties, and other local property taxing jurisdictions whose taxable lands would be included. So this bill would require everybody to agree, basically, so the special districts would be included at the table.
Okay.
Looks, from my read, would have to basically put their stamp on it saying we agree to this. So it seems to be this is significantly different than what we have in urban renewal today. I when I first read this, I said, well, this is urban renewal light for rural airports. I mean, that's how I kind of read this, and I see you're nodding your head. So does that help, Senator?
Yes, thank you.
Great. Let's go ahead and move on, Mr. Anderson.
Committee Chair and members of the committee, my name is W.L. Anderson, and I go by Andy, and I live at 803 Cessna Street in Independence, Oregon, in the Independence Air Park. I have been a pilot for 60 years, and I am concerned with the closure of airports because of the economic and population pressures for development near the airports. I am the former AOPA Airports Support Network representative for the Independence Airport, and concerned about the AOPA statement that one airport is being closed every 2 years in the nation. I am a board member of the Oregon Flying Farmers, the Oregon Pilots Association, and the Oregon Agricultural Alliance, who has sponsored and supported House Bill 3153. This bill had the first public hearing last evening in this room, and only one of our group was able to testify because of time constraints. The bill has been taken over by the Joint Land Use Fairness Committee, to use as a vehicle to help fix the Measure 37 issues, by what I understand is the gut and stuff in legislative terms.
We've all been victims of that, Mr. Anderson, and sometimes perpetrators.
Well, consequently, we were not able to testify, and we're still anxious to protect airports. And it looks to us like this might be an opportunity to tie in with the this bill, the 807, Senate Bill 807. The essence of the original 3153 was to reinstate the right to farm law and allow certain law creation of the airport protection boundaries around private use airports. There is already an RS for airport planning, but the administrative rules do not include residential air parks. Our request is to define and include air parks in an airport protection boundary. Air parks are one of the best neighbors for airports, as they are home for pilots and those interested in aviation. What other residents consider as noise from airplanes and associated activities is music to the ears of pilots. Air parks also provide revenue for the support through ingress-egress fees by increasing the assessed value of, and also by increasing the assessed value of the property for taxing purposes. Mm-hmm. Independence Airport is a good example and a positive example for air parks next to an airport. As I read Senate Bill 807 and visited with Aaron Fagery, I was impressed with the possibility our idea of an airport protection boundary might fit well within the airport tax increment financing district. Therefore, I am asking if the residential air park could be included in Senate Bill 807 as a through-the-fence business. Thank you for your time and listening to my request to include residential air parks in the airport tax increment financing district.
Thank you, Mr. Anderson. Questions for Mr. Anderson? Okay. My grandfather's name was Andy Anderson. So. Thank you very much. Committee, what I would like to do, I have no one else signed up to testify on this bill. We have some amendments coming. There's some more discussion. As you know, we have 1 week left to do that. This does have a subsequent referral to Finance and Revenue, which does not have the same time constraints, and Senator Starr, of course, and Senator Decker on that committee. So it would be my desire to move ahead so they can continue to work on the bill, if that's okay with you. If that's the case, I will close the public hearing, Senate Bill 807, and open a work session on Senate Bill 807.
Mr. Chair, I move the bill, Senate Bill 807, to the Committee on Finance and Revenue.
Okay, Senator Starr has moved Senate Bill 807 to the Committee on Finance and Revenue. Without recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. So we'll continue to work on that there. Thank you. Excuse me? Yes. Show Senator Jordan, Senator Decker to excuse. Now we'll open up public hearing. I'm going to move ahead a little bit here to Senate Bill 789, because Senator Przanski is here. So Senator Przanski wants to come forward.
Which one?
789. And I'll ask Janet to give us a brief summary of Senate Bill 789, and then ask Senator Przanski and to discuss the bill. Janet.
Mr. Chair, Senate Bill 789 would direct the creation of a Share the Road license plate program to observe the importance of sharing the road with bicyclists. The plates would be available under the original bill for cars, light trucks, hybrid vehicles, and motor homes. The Dash 1 amendments authorize Share the Road plate as a nonprofit group plate under the existing group plate program, is my understanding. There's a $5 per year surcharge on the plates, and it would be directed into an account designated by the Bicycle Transportation Alliance and Cycle Oregon, split evenly between the two groups. And it directs the department to work with the two groups on design of the plate.
Thank you, Janet. Senator Przanski, welcome.
Thank you, Chair Mexler and Senators. Senate Bill 789 is filed on behalf of Tom Jefferson, and as a memory and memorial to his wife, Jane Higdon. Jane was an avid cyclist, triathlete. and a very good friend of mine was actually one of my writing partners for the past 6 years. She was tragically killed this last year on May 31st when she was crushed under a truck while she was riding her bike. Jane, in her professional life, was at OSU as a researcher and nutritionist, very on the front and cutting edge of her work there, and she's an individual that touched many people in her life as a athlete, as well as a professional individual and as a community member. What Thomas Jefferson, Tom and I are friends as well. We've talked about what is it that we can do to try to help get more education into the communities as to hoping and that we can get a better understanding of what our current vehicle laws provide for, as bicycles being vehicles, and that vehicles equally share the road, and that we need to try to get a better understanding and recognition that all vehicles have the right to the road and at the same time have their duty to share the road. This is a bill that we are asking to move forward because under the group license plate requirement, it does take legislation to enact this type of procedure and process to try to enhance education. It's worth noting that the Department of Transportation is currently in the process of doing a Share the Road campaign. Their campaign is geared at very similar to not only bicycles but also trucks and automobiles, and how each and every one of those different vehicle types need to respect each other and share the road. There's also, I know, a commemorative sign that is being proposed in the House bill that Representative Crummell is moving forward, and I've also signed on to that, which would also give recognition in a different way where there's actually been a fatality, and as the bill is currently written, where there's been a conviction of an individual for that that death, to basically allow for a sign to be placed at the place at the location of where the fatality is, with a in memory of underneath the sign. And that sign would be one that would be showing a vehicle, a car, as well as a bicycle next to each other, with the sign saying share the road. So this is an extension of that, and what we are wanting to do is basically allow for individuals who would be interested in spreading that message to have that opportunity through license plates. As all of us know, these group license plates, as well as what are the specialty license plates, actually have had an impact on many people within the in the state as to getting information, and this is one way that we could actually get a message out that would be very simple and very direct as to wanting to make certain that people understand the duty that we all have. So that's the framework. We do have it set up where there would be a surcharge for the issuance of the plates. That money would actually go into two organizations. Those nonprofit organizations are the Bicycle Transportation Alliance, the BTA, Scott Bricker, who is the legislative liaison of that committee and organization, was not able to be here because of other obligations that he had in the Portland area. He and I have spoken at some length on this, and they are receptive to being one of the nonprofits that would be named. We are in the process of now looking, as you probably know, to have this type of group plate move forward. There is a obligation on the part of the applicants to actually be able to fund the process, and the three groups that are considering putting money in as groups include the BTA, the Cycle Oregon. We have not gone into great detail as to what those type of contributions would be, but we understand the obligation is on the part of the requesters, and also the Oregon Truckers Association. I have been in contact with Bob Russell. Bob and I have worked together since Jane's death, and he has made it very clear to me that the association is looking for ways to try to help enhance the education, and he said this would be one of the areas that they would be willing to consider. So at this point, we're asking you to move forward Senate Bill 789 to allow this process to go forward for the group plate. I have with me today, and as on your list of people to testify, Jerry Norquist, who's with Cycle Oregon, and also Jack Evans with the Department of Transportation, the DMV section.
Okay.
Thank you, Senator.
Thank you.
Mr. Norquist, let's start with you.
Yes, my name is Jerry Norquist, and I'm the executive director of Cycle Oregon. I'd like to thank Senator Pruszynski, and I'd like to thank the committee for the opportunity to testify in favor of Senate Bill 789. Oregon has a long history of leading the country with bicycle and pedestrian issues. We are the only state in the United States that has a bicycle bill that has given us a small percentage of our tax dollars to put into bicycle and pedestrian issues. Along with that, we in Oregon have more bicycle-friendly cities than any other state in the Union. And that is an award that is given to cities in Oregon by the League of American Bicyclists. Portland, as you probably know, has been named over the last 2 years as the number one bicycling city in the country. And Oregon has been voted by the International Mountain Bike Association as the number one mountain bike destination in the country. We also are the first state to put scenic bikeways into play, and Oregon is the only state where our congressmen and our senators on the federal level are all members of the Bike Caucus. So we do lead in a lot of areas. And I just, there are a number of states that have license plates already, and we are kind of off the charts on that one. We're not in that list of states. I think there are 10 states that currently have plates or are ready to have them in play. I guess my question, so why does it make sense to share the road with bicycles, and why does it make sense to state this on a license plate and make it part of our public policy? I would say this because bicycles are a solution to a number of our national issues. There are a number of people in Oregon working on making Oregon the number one cycling destination in the country. We just held our second annual state bike conference in Sisters, Oregon. The sponsors of that statewide bike conference are ODOT, the Oregon Department of Transportation, State Parks, Travel Oregon, Cycle Oregon, and the Bicycle Transportation Alliance. And again, Scott Bricker was not able to be here today. So bicycles are part of the solution to a lot of the problems we have right now. Just having attended the National Bicycle Summit in D.C., three of those issues that are very important to us right now are the environmental issue of global warming. Bicycles contribute to stopping what we see as a real problem there. They provide major health benefits. We currently have an obesity epidemic in this country, and bicycles will help solve that problem. And we can lower congestion in our cities by bicycling. So the point I'm trying to get to is that we need to make a public statement, and it needs to be part of our public policy, that we should be sharing the road with bicycles. Every year at Cycle Oregon, we give the riders a license plate to put on their bicycle, and it gives them the opportunity to state where they came from, and it's just sort of a meeting sign for them. They can start up a conversation with other people. But over the years, hundreds of people have come up to me that are cyclists, and they've said, can you do something about getting a license plate that we can buy for our cars so that we can make a statement? We're also motorists, and we drive every day, and we'd like to make a statement that we support cycling. Cycle Oregon's mission is economic development in rural communities, but it's also education. And we know that by educating cyclists to sharing the road, we can solve some of the problems. And Tom Jefferson, who you spoke about, Senator Pruszynski, spoke at the statewide bike conference and explained what had happened a year ago to his wife. And I know he would like very much to have a public policy in place that helps that kind of thing from happening again. Thank you for your time and for letting me testify.
Thank you, Mr. Norquist. I think we'll go to Jack next.
Chair Metzger, members of the committee, Jack Evans of the Department of Transportation. And I think we've pretty much covered most of the points about this this group plate. DMV will work in consultation with the two mentioned nonprofit groups, the Bicycle Transportation Alliance and the Cycle Oregon, to design a share the road plate. And this will be either on a decal on a tree plate, or a new design with a new background. So this will be a little bit different than your typical group plate. As was mentioned, there'll be a one-time $10 surcharge on these plates. The fees will be paid to the both these organizations evenly, and the cost of implementing the plate will be paid up front by these organizations, which includes a $10,000 application fee that's in statute that's refundable if 1,000 plates are sold in the first 12 months. So should we move forward with this legislation, we'll be looking at putting together a plate. And just as an example, I think Senator Prezansky looked at the plate that's in existence in the state of Washington as an example of a unique background as something that might be considered. Another option is to take a tree plate and have a rather than four letter configuration, have three, and then have this larger area here have a design using a decal. So we stand ready to work with these groups on these designs.
Thank you, Mr. Evans. So clarify something with me first. Under our current statutes that we enacted in 2003, which provides these opportunities for different groups to have these plates, with as Senator Prezansky and Mr. Norquist have outlined, what is it in our current statute, that allows to get the groups together and the money and to do this, that that isn't currently sufficient to be able to have them seek this type of plate? I'm just trying to figure out what where the gap is in the legislation that we passed in 2003 that allow groups to create things like this, and to what they're trying to come at with this legislation.
Sure. Chair Metzger, in the majority of situations, that is the case. There's a process where a group will come in and pay all the costs of DMV, the $10,000 fee. And then if they sell 1,000 plates in the first 12 months, they'll get that application fee back. And then they're required to sell 500 plates or renew 500 plates every subsequent year in order to remain active. The thing that why legislation is required in this particular situation is because we're talking about a logo. In the majority of situations, we'll have just words. But in some plates, we have, for example, on the university plates and on the Purple Heart plate, we actually have a picture on that license plate. In order to do that, we have to have legislation to allow us to put a picture on it. We don't have authority to design a new plate or to put a picture on it unless it's specifically addressed in statute. Hence, we're having this bill come forward because of the request for either a special design or for a decal on a tree plate.
Okay, so just so I understand this, it is the authority to use a decal. All the rest of this stuff could be done under current law, and with the way they have approached it, be the same way, except that the decal presents the issue.
That's correct.
Because it's no secret about it. Since I wrote the 2003 law trying to help reduce the number of plates that we have, my own general philosophy is that a license plate is to help police identify your vehicle. It's not a billboard. But I recognize that, we have some of these things, and there are some values to some of those, and that's why we created the legislation, so that groups, and Senator Prezansky, your group may very well be one of those that has sufficient support to sustain a plate, and the cost that the department would do. And so in making the legislation, we said, okay, you can do these things, but somebody besides you has to want this, because we had all those examples of plates. Someone had a great idea, and 10 years later, after all the expense and vaults full of plates, they issued one plate, five plates, six plates in 10 years. And so the threshold was put, so that the proponents would actually put some thought behind it. Yes, we can support it, and we're willing to say that by putting the upfront cost and the getting back. And I think that was a fair way to do it. And I'm very sensitive to what Senator Prezansky wants to do here, and I think that they thought that process out. I guess the thing that I'm thinking about in terms of the deluge of others to do different things, and on this one is very close to existing law, so that's a lot better, you know, than trying to create a whole new idea. I was wondering if there is there something that we can do, perhaps with this legislation, which would give you the authority on the decal situation itself. In other words, where it's generic enough that you can apply it to this bill or anything else without necessarily, creating a specific one, which then opens the door to the next five plates that people come tomorrow for. But because it sounds like they could do it now except for the decal. And I just wondered if we could make the thing so that they could actually get the decal without actually going to legislation for it. That's what I'm thinking of, and yet it doesn't necessarily open the door to everybody else who hasn't thought through this process like these folks have, putting pressure on individual legislators to create another play in which there hasn't been necessarily the support that this group probably would have.
Senator Metzger, I believe in talking to DMV and learning the license plate business in my first 6 months here, one of the things that frightens DMV is the notion of having the door flung open and just having a barrage of symbols and designs and whatever it could be. Mm-hmm. In the extreme, you could have the swastikas or Confederate flags or whatever, but the notion is that these plates ultimately belong to the state of Oregon and they represent the state of Oregon wherever you drive. So there's a considerable amount of concern about the precedents you set in putting pictures on plates and the ability to control that and having something blossom into tens, twenties, hundreds of plates that have pictures on them. And getting to the point where the law enforcement may be able to not figure out, is that an Oregon plate or what is that? So that would be the caution on just throwing the door open to having any kind of a decal on the plates. We're actually grateful, if you will, that we have the opportunity to approach the legislature and thoughtfully look at each design and go forward in that fashion rather than being presented, because we're finding now that people are just about everybody that's coming to us have some sort of a picture in mind they want to have on their plate. So,
okay.
And that's ultimately, of course, a policy decision for the legislature.
Okay. Well, I appreciate that background. Senator, you had a comment there?
Yeah, I did. Thank you, Chair. I guess my understanding is the way we set this up in the legislature in 2003 was basically giving a check and balance. So we wouldn't have everyone going directly to ODOT and saying, this is what I want. And they would not be able to have, quote unquote, some type of filter or screening and potentially having the legislature wondering, why did this plate get this decal, blah, blah, blah. So there's a check and balance there. Now, I think the other part is if you were actually wanting to go there, this particular bill probably would not allow us to do that because the relating clause was narrowly written to be just share the road.
Plate. We have other relating clauses.
Let's let you know that this, you know, one of those thoughts that I felt comfortable with this because it wasn't something
sure.
that was going to be a door swinger.
Right. Okay. Well, I appreciate that. Other questions? Well, thank you very much. We'll chat about this afterwards and see what we can do on that. Close the public hearing on Senate Bill 789. And we'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 863. Do we have our list on that?
I think sometimes.
Okay. I think I'll start with this one since this is my bill. Senate Bill 863, you'll remember, colleagues, along with Senate Joint Resolution 33, we heard in Milwaukee last month, dealing with the use of automated dialing calls. And we had a very, very interesting discussion there and testimony on the issue. What evolved from that is, and the discussion is, what I took away from it was that people indeed were very concerned about the harm issue, but they were concerned about limiting it for positive purposes and how we might get around that. Also with the constitutional issues that would be involved, which is why we had the Senate Joint Resolution, an amendment to the Constitution, to actually do that. And so I backed off that a little bit, and I worked with the Attorney General's office, who have been supportive of this legislation, and asked them if they could narrow the scope of Senate Bill 863 so that it no longer required a constitutional amendment, did not change any of the speech issues, but dealt simply with the harm caused by automatic dialing devices. And so I had the legislation weaned from the department through by the Department of Justice. To look at those issues that created harm and could be standalone issues. And those are comprised in what we have as the amendments to Senate Bill 863, would not require a constitutional change and would deal specifically with the harms caused by the automated dialing devices. Specifically what they are is, and you have a copy of the amendment, and does everybody have a mock-up also?
I think everybody.
Okay. But let me tell you specifically what they do, and we'll have people testifying on this. Number one, it focuses on the harm of the automated dialing device rather than the content of the speech or the broadness of it. It still maintains the same prohibitions or rather the opportunities created in the current national, federal, and state no-call list. It prohibits a caller from misrepresenting or falsifying information. I had to delete the part, however, that required them to say who they really were because that was a speech issue. But you can, it's not free speech to tell people they can't be dishonest about who they are representing. So that is in the bill. It prohibits an automated device from a situation where you would incur any unwanted expense. For example, you call your call. If you call a cell phone, and they can call a cell phone, especially if you've listed that in your voter file, and that is your phone, and it has an expense, that could be a right of that would be a violation. If it causes the loss of your subscriber line for any period of time, this is the case in which we heard the testimony where some people who have not been using these efficiently or correctly, where you would listen to the message and hang up, and then it would not free up the dial tone, and your dial tone would be held hostage for a period of time. Besides occupying your line, also any other, you know, expense harm that would be caused as a result of that, if you are on a no-call list, that is a presumption that you also have decided that it's a harm, you do not want to be called, that the list would have to be weaned against that list. It has the regular exceptions on it that the no-call list has. It also says you cannot manipulate the caller ID when you are making a robocall. So those are the essential elements. Normally, I would ask the Attorney General to come up first, but I'm going to do this a little bit differently. I'm going to let him do cleanup because he has all the answers. So I'm going to call the people in opposition. Jim Markey, Elise Brown didn't sign up, but I know she must be in opposition, and Moses Ross to come forward.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Jim Markey, representing the Oregon Collectors Association, an association of third-party debt collectors. I'm not sure that we're really in opposition of the bill. I had sent the bill to our attorney, and I apologize that I wasn't able to be in Milwaukee with you. And our attorney sent me a memo, which I made copies for the committee, and he had several concerns about the bill as it was originally written, and these concerns are outlined in the memo, but they speak to the original bill.
Right.
And your amendments actually have taken care of part of those problems, I think, but perhaps created others, and I'm trying to play catch-up with you. So third-party debt collectors, collection agencies, if you will, are regulated by the Federal Trade Commission for purposes of these kinds of calls under an act called the Federal Fair Debt Collection Practices Act. And the Federal Trade Commission has a whole bevy of regulations and rules regarding what can be done and what can't be done regarding these kinds of calls. And so it occurred to me that that didn't appear to be the emphasis for this bill, and that you had in some ways attempted to take out collection calls from debt collection calls from the purview of this, at least part of this bill. But the piece of the bill that takes out debt collection calls simply says that they are exempt from subsection 1 of section 2, and that still means that we would be regulated for the activity under this bill, and the regulations that this bill prescribe, I think, are different than, not necessarily worse or better, but different than some of the provisions that were regulated under the Federal Fair Debt Collection Practices Act for. So, again, some of those have been fixed by the issue. One of the major issues for us is the issue of identification. If you are collecting a debt from a debtor under the federal law, you have to identify yourself if you're speaking to them, but they now have a regulation that prohibits you from having a recording that does that, because you might be identifying yourself to, it might be a third-party disclosure that's otherwise prohibited under the law, so you're prohibited from doing that. And I see that you did, I think, take that, if I'm correct here, took that provision out of the bill, and so that probably corrects that. But in the other amendments, where on page 2, line 2, the language said that you were exempt from subsection 1 of section 2 if you were attempting to collect a debt from the subscriber. The amendments appear to me to change that line to say that you are that the subscriber owes a debt to the caller, and by definition, our folks are third-party debt collectors, and so in many, while there may be an instance where they are collecting a debt owed to them or the company that they work for, mm-hmm. there would be other instances where they were collecting a debt for someone else and acting in that capacity, and so that would be, I think, problematic for our folks. And I don't think any of those things are things that can't be fixed. I'd just like an opportunity to do that, and I apologize for not being in Milwaukee. That was my fault. I had a conflict, but I simply would like an opportunity to fix it. Because third-party debt collectors are so highly regulated, mm-hmm. under the Federal Fair Debt Collection Practices Act, and they really are, and there is a special right of action under that act for aggrieved parties, and collection agencies get sued all the time for that if they violate it. The simple fix for us would be that you would, for those people regulated by the federal act, that they simply would not be regulated by this because they're already regulated by the federal act. And I would be happy to share those standards and those regulations with the committee if you have any interest in doing that. I think that would be our first preference, because anytime you have federal and state and they're different, and you have a hard time, sometimes you violate one if you don't violate the other. So that's our concern. So
thank you, Mr. Markey. A couple of things. Number one, just to make sure we're clear, this has involved automatic calls only, not real people calling. So this is only automatic robocalls. So generally, most debt collectors have a conversation with you, trying to talk to you. But just to make sure that's clear, this does not affect real live calls. And the second part of it is in terms of, and I know with some other bills we've had this issue before in terms of the federal, but there's no real right of action for the individual the FTC, for example, or SEC, doesn't take an individual case. They do group enforcement action. And one of the key parts about this, as Mr. Shepherd will testify, it gives the state right to come to bat on behalf of an individual. So even if you have federal laws, you don't necessarily have, you don't have, the federal government is going to come and, you know, do Rick Metzger personally and take legal action necessarily on me. So we've had that with some of those other issues, which is part of the reason to bring that under that umbrella.
And Mr. Chair, if I could respond. Debt collectors, collection agencies, use automatic dialers. They use automatic dialers almost every large collection agency now uses automatic dialers. They do use those automatic dialers in conjunction with live debt collectors, but they also oftentimes have, if you have an automatic dialer dialing 10 numbers at a time and you've got five debt collectors and all five debt collectors are busy when you make a connection, there sometimes is a recording. So in that, they would fall under the purview of this bill. I mean, there's just no question about that. And I recognize that it doesn't apply to live debt collectors, but they would be using this type of equipment, and they would fall under the purview of the bill.
Right. No question. No question about that, which is why we mentioned that they owe a debt to the caller.
And I would just say, with respect to the Federal Trade Commission, they've taken lots of actions against lots of debt collectors, and this area is a particular area of concern to them. And there, but beyond that, there is a right of private action by the debtor. If the debtor feels aggrieved by any violation of a regulation or rule under the Federal Fair Debt Collection Practices Act, they have a right of private action granted them under that act. And so that's probably the bigger enforcement tool, if you will, because I can guarantee you there are lots of consumer lawyers out there ready to file those actions, and they do all the time.
So, thank you.
Thank you.
Ms. Brown?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee. Elise Brown, representing Singular Wireless, the new AT&T. And back again, I did have an opportunity to visit with all of you at Milwaukee High School.
And we appreciate that.
And you missed out. And my remarks really piggyback again just from what Mr. Marquis said. But what I did have an opportunity to point out to you earlier is our issue really was in the definition of established business relationship. Now, many of the concerns that he just explained with third-party debt collectors are our issue. And what's troubling for us is in the original bill having subscriber consented to the call. And what I offered to share with you, which I did in fact, was the federal definition that doesn't have that language in there, and hoping still to work with you on that. Otherwise, I think we'd be fine with it. We appreciate what you're trying to do and the intent here. So we'd like to continue to work with you to use that federal definition.
Okay. Thank you. Mr. Ross, welcome.
Welcome. Thank you. I also was able to attend the Milwaukee High School meeting, and it was a real pleasure to be able to share my opinion with you there. And just in my previous...
Oh, I'm sorry. For the record, please.
Oh, pardon me. Moses Ross. I own a company called politicalrobocalls.com, specializing in automated calls for the use of politicians and nonprofits. In my previous testimony in Milwaukee to this committee, I discussed how the ethical and the appropriate use of automated phone calls can benefit the general public in many ways as far as their use by the political and the nonprofit communities, and that the existing federal regulations for these types of calls is sufficient as far as ensuring that the general public is protected by the unscrupulous use of these calls or the inappropriate use of these calls. Today I'd like to briefly focus on the need on exempting the political and nonprofit communities from this bill, from the use of automated calls. Specifically, I'd like to focus on the educational benefits that these...
I would like, Mr. Ross, I don't have time for that today. We did that last time. I'd like to have you talk about the amendment, the five harms that we have here, and why they are still a problem for you or not.
Actually, to be quite honest with you, the amendments as far as harm... I have no challenge with whatsoever. I think it's very appropriate, and once again, the ethical use of these types of automated phone calls have systems that will immediately disconnect within the proper time frames, and so I think it's very appropriate. I just would like to present to the committee that the existing federal regulations do exempt political and nonprofit use, and I also would like to present the potential of including an opt-out, requiring an opt-out method in the call that is the technology is available for. So that would eliminate that concern of the right of action, I would believe, and for the individual to be able to make sure that they are placed onto some sort of a do not call list without having to take further steps. Mm-hmm. The technology allows for the pressing of a keypad to immediately put them onto a do not, an internal do not call list. That call list could then in turn be shared with the state by the provider. Mm-hmm. And so,
well, that, you know, that's interesting. And you know, in the amendment, one of the limitations is if they are on the federal slash state do not call list. Mm-hmm. So there already is a mechanism for them to be on that list. Would have to be cross checked against any, you know, list that you might use for robocalls to delete those. Would be part of that.
I would suggest that with the concern of if political, i.e., registered voters, are considered for exemption, and the nonprofit communities are considered for exemption, that the opt-out method that I referred to may be included as a part of this required part of the use of the robocall. That would alleviate any concerns as far as potentially scrubbing against those lists in the first place, but still would allow for the proper use and the education of the constituency and of the community by the politicians and by the nonprofits.
Mm-hmm. I appreciate that. In all candor, the biggest issue is really the political calls, because that's where the problems come in. And but why we tried to narrow it through those who are trying to manipulate or falsify, as opposed to being able to actually make those.
Another question.
Senator Starr.
Senator Ross, you obviously run a business here.
Yes.
In your expertise, your experience, under the Dash 2 amendments, would you be able to continue to operate your business and serve, you know,
as I understand,
legislators and candidates and political groups?
As the bill is written now, no, because of the fact that there is no exemption.
But as for the Dash 2 amendments, the amendments,
yes,
that
I would be able to.
Has proposed.
Yes, I would.
You would not harm your ability to serve legislators, candidates, political groups,
no,
or any other customer?
It would not. The technology is there available to be able to fulfill the requirements of the amendments.
Great. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Senator. Any other questions for this group? Senator George.
Yes, Mr. Ross, I tend to be more with you, and I express it to the Chair. So if the Dash 2 amendments are adopted, are you okay with the bill, or are you still opposed to the bill?
I would still be opposed to it because of the lack of an exemption for political use and for nonprofit community use.
Thank you.
If that exemption was in, I would be in favor of the bill.
Not political, Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I thought the political calls.
They are in here.
They are?
Yes. No, that is, that actually is, as I mentioned, is really one of the major focuses of it.
Yeah. As it stands right now, it's a blanket ban.
Yeah. Because, and again, as we heard on the free speech issue in our first one, that we can't just select political or business, because that would be we would be picking one group or another. So what we're advising, Mr. Shepard is about to come forward, to stay within the current Oregon Constitution, is that you find out what the harm is, and then everyone has to it has to apply to everybody. So nobody can manipulate, nobody can grab the line. You can't just say political people can and these people can't. And that's where we got into the constitutional issue. So thank you all very much.
Thank you.
Mr. Shepard. Welcome, and thanks for hanging around, too.
My pleasure, Mr. Chair.
And I appreciate your work on the bill, and I thought if you could kind of walk through us what this does and the Department of Justice, the feelings on it, and And as I had, I think, kind of qualified when I started the discussion today, is that I specifically asked the Department of Justice what they could defend against the current Constitution without having to change it. And so that was the product, essentially, of what we have before us. Mr. Shepard.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Pete Shepard. I'm the Deputy Attorney General. As you have indicated, you asked that we take a look at the originally printed bill to determine which elements, if any, of the printed bill that we could defend in good faith against an attack under Article 1, Section 8 of the Oregon Constitution. And as you recall from your prior hearing, I gather that you had considerable testimony or some testimony about the requirements of that provision of the Constitution. And as the Chair has aptly summarized, the key rule of law that emerges from that part of the Constitution and from the cases interpreting it is one that requires the Legislative Assembly to focus its work on the effects, not on the content of speech. And it's for that, or of expression more precisely, and it's for that reason that if you were to pass a version of this bill which purported to distinguish based on the content of the communication rather than on its effects, that version would be very vulnerable to successful constitutional attack. So we looked at the elements of the printed bill to identify, as the Oregon Supreme Court has said, whether the actual focus of the enactment is on an effect or harm rather than on the substance of the communication itself. And so the Dash 2 amendments reflect extractions from the original printed bill that, in the view of the Department of Justice, focused on the harm, not on the content of the expression. And you've heard those described, I think, here. And in our judgment, we could, in good faith, defend the elements of the Dash 2 amendments. I should give you the caution that there's a lot of litigation in this Article 1, Section 8 area, and it's a very challenging notion to distinguish.
More employment for the Department of Justice employers.
Indeed, Mr. Chair. Employment started today. I actually hand engrossed for Mr. Marquis's use a version of the bill earlier this evening. But the bottom line is we have good faith and we think fairly strong arguments to defend the Dash 2 amendments against the attack that very likely would arise. Let me mention just two other points of law and then answer questions. First, as to the remedy that's provided in the Dash 2 amendments, on page 2, line 24, the remedy that's provided is by enforcement under ORS 646-632. That statute is a part of the Oregon Unlawful Trade Practices Act that gives the Attorney General authority to bring an action to enforce the prohibitions that are established as violations of that act. And under that provision of law, we would not be acting as the lawyer for an individual consumer, but we would act upon complaints by individual consumers, and that provision of law allows us to obtain relief for individual consumers in the course of our work on behalf of the people of the state of Oregon. And so that's the remedy that's provided in the Dash 2 amendments. And then finally, there's been some discussion, Mr. Marquis discussed the interrelationship with federal law, and I'm not prepared to advise and been asked to look at, and I'm not prepared to give you an off-the-cuff view about whether there would be any element of federal law that would preempt the Dash 2 amendments. The way to think through that question, though, I think, would be, Mr. Marquis was careful to say, I think, that it's possible that the federal law imposes different requirements, and it may well. But the legal analysis would be, are those different requirements more restrictive or in conflict with the requirements of the Dash 2 amendments? And then, if they were, you'd have to analyze whether that federal law preempted the Dash 2 amendments. If they were not more restrictive, if they were less restrictive, if the Dash 2 amendments are less restrictive than the federal law, then the question of preemption really wouldn't be an issue because the federal law would be enforced in any event. So you'd have to think, you have to do some more work to determine whether there's a preemption problem is all I'm suggesting on that question.
Questions for Mr. Shepard. Mr. Shepard, I was curious. In next week, we will have the Attorney General's conformance, Senate Bill 117, with the federal no-call list back again, and hopefully have that clarification. We heard your bill before on that. And I'm curious, in terms of your office, in this whole general topic, in terms of, I know you're not DCBS, a lot of people will call there first, but in terms of what type of issues do you hear about the general issue on the no-call, whether they're automated dial-ins like this bill or just the generic calls I'm being intruded upon? How much do you hear about that in the Department of Justice?
Well, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I first have to disclaim any direct knowledge. It's been 8 years since I supervised our consumer protection financial fraud section, so I have only derivative knowledge of that. But I do know that in connection with the no-call provision, that there were 15,000 complaints from Oregonians about no-call violations in 2006 lodged with the federal agency that's responsible now for the only enforcement game in town as to no-call. And because of the effective federal preemption of state no-call enforcement, we couldn't do anything about any of those 15,000 complaints. And unfortunately, our federal partners also did nothing about those complaints. So Oregonians do have complaints about the way their telephones are used, that at least as to those 15,000 Oregonians. They didn't want to get the kind of commercial calls that are the kind of calls that are covered by the no-call law, and I presume some of those Oregonians anyway would be interested in the provisions of this bill as well.
Okay. Thank you. Again, any questions for Mr. Sheffield?
I have a question.
Yes, Minister.
The penalty under subsection 5, if the bill is drafted, mentions the 2,000 per and three times actual. That's been amended out. Can you talk about what the penalties may be under, I forget what the exact ORS is, that's ORS 646-632. Can you tell us what penalties are there?
Mr. Chair, Senator Starr, the Unlawful Trade Practices Act has a very wide array of penalties that the Attorney General can pursue, including civil penalties of, I think, up to $25,000 per violation. That's, of course, a judgment call that the Attorney General makes in the exercise of prosecutorial authority, and that's always scaled in relationship to the magnitude of the violation. We can also seek attorney's fees if it's necessary for us to bring an action against a violator. But a key thing about the remedy provided in the Unlawful Trade Practices Act, as enforced by the Attorney General under 632, is that this is not a sue-first enforcement scheme. The statute, the Legislative Assembly has set up a system in which the first thing the Attorney General is supposed to do under 632, under most circumstances, is tender to the violator basically a settlement agreement. It's called an assurance of voluntary compliance. It's not an admission of any violation of law. And taking the no-call enforcement scheme, when we had authority to do that before we were preempted by federal law, as an example, typically we would tender an assurance of voluntary compliance for the first violation that said, don't do this and pay a nominal fine. And that's the kind of enforcement scheme that we had. So there is the Unlawful Trade Practices Act does provide a very wide array of remedies, including some very heavy hammers, and it leaves the determination of the magnitude of the sanction to be sought to the discretion, essentially, of the Attorney General.
Mr. Chair, that provides me a significant amount of angst as it relates to this bill. I would much rather we spell out $25,000 fine per. And with all due respect to Mr. Shepard, I have had businesses contact me that have been, in my estimation, treated poorly, basically to the point of being put out of business through this voluntary compliance whole process that the 646-632 sets up. That makes me really, really nervous about this. Really nervous.
So, Mr. Shepard, is there, what Senator Starr is saying is, something doesn't like the higher end of that for what we're trying to accomplish. Is what type of, do you have different types of approaches, I mean, statutory approaches with unlawful trade practices and what you could apply those differently depending on what the issue is that you're, I don't mean discretionary, but I mean statutorily change your, I mean, if we were to change this and so we specified something different in terms of the maximum, you know, types of penalties.
Mr. Chair, Senator Starr, I don't know of any model for this, but I can't think of any legal reason that you couldn't do this as a matter of policy if you chose to. You could provide in the bill that notwithstanding the penalties otherwise available under the Unlawful Trade Practices Act to the Attorney General, you could constrict those if you wished.
Okay.
That certainly is a legitimate policy option that you have. I can't think of a model where the Assembly has done that, and I think the reason that it hasn't done that is that we have in the Unlawful Trade Practices Act a flexible tool that accommodates now the worst of the worst as well as the person who makes a relatively benign mistake. But I appreciate the concern about prosecutorial discretion, and that is I understand the concern. I respectfully, I'd be interested in the particular cases because we're always concerned about a suggestion that we've used our authority in an improper way, but I grant the point.
Senator George.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm trying to look at the amendments and figure out exactly the harms, and there's in the dash 2 amendments, line 13 through 15, on the first page, it says, lose the use of recording or memory capacity built into the subscriber's answering machine voicemail system that would otherwise be available for the subscriber's own purposes. And I guess I'm trying to get at, as I read this bill, if you were a political firm, you could call somebody with a live call and leave them a message, take up their memory space, and that's okay. But if you call them with an automated machine to do the same thing, that wouldn't be okay. And I don't quite get how you enforce this right here. So if I have 5 messages on my machine, I still have memory space available. Is there no harm? Or if I have, let's say, for instance, I have 6 political calls that are live that take up all the space, and I leave 1 automated call, am I then fined for this? I mean, this right here probably is the most troublesome, I think, of all the enforcement. If you could describe that for me and how you envision that being enforced, I'd appreciate it.
Mr. Chair, Senator George, I think that on the plain language of lines 13 through 15, as I would read that, it does not require the call that causes the harm to be the last one in the chain, if you will. The one that finally fills up the machine is not necessarily the one that causes the harm. The harm is defined in the language of line 13 anyway, losing the use of memory capacity. I think that's not precisely language that the Department of Justice drafted, mind you, but the way I would read that is that losing the use of memory capacity in the ordinary and conventional meaning of those words would be using up a portion of the memory capacity.
So Mr. Chair, I want to make sure. So what we're saying here in this and that with these amendments is that an automated machine person who is using it for a nonprofit or political purpose or any other purpose could not leave a message on your answering machine or on your voicemail system.
Mr. Chair, Senator George, I think that's right on the language of line 13 because it would be using up memory capacity that would otherwise be available for the subscriber's own purpose.
And so, Mr. Chair, if I could.
Yeah.
So as I understand it, the scenario I put forward is correct. If I paid somebody, you know, a dollar to make a live call, they could leave a message machine, but if a person paid 6 cents, they're running against an incumbent, paid 6 cents, they couldn't leave the same answer. They couldn't leave exactly the same message. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Senator George, it's correct, but it's important to recognize that the difference in the harm that's addressed there. And the reason that that's not a distinction based on the content of the expression is that the automated dialing device continues to use up for the length of the automated message the amount of capacity that it takes up however long it goes on. Whereas in the oral conversation, the recipient of the call terminates the harm, the intrusion in their privacy, for example, if we assume it to be harm, by hanging up on the caller. So that's the reason that there's a distinction, a logical distinction. You could perhaps draft it differently, but as to the language, that is the effect of it.
Mr. Chair, I guess what I'm saying is when you, a lot of times when you pay people to do live calls, they leave messages on your message machine.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't understand what the difference of the harm would be.
I take your point now. I understand the point, and I think that that would cause the same kind of harm. I don't think that that would expose the bill, though, to a constitutional attack, because it is addressed only to the harms caused by the ADAD machines and not similar harms caused by other intrusions.
Mr. Chair, if I could, you got two political speeches, and they say exactly the same thing and have exactly the same message.
Mm-hmm.
One you pay a dollar for, and one you pay 6.5 or 7 cents for. They're exactly the same message. They have exactly the same harm. They're using exactly the same phone line. How can that not be discrimination on based on financial interest? I mean, I just, from my perspective, that just seems, it's the same exact political speech.
Mr. Chair, Senator George, you've raised a different kind of potential constitutional challenge now. And let me explain that. Let's assume that we're dealing with a free expression, valid, an enactment by the Assembly that does not violate Article 1, Section 8, the Free Expression Clause. So it's constitutional from that standpoint. Assume that for a moment. And what you're suggesting is that there is another kind of challenge to that prohibition, and it is that that prohibition doesn't go and extend to an identical harm that isn't covered by the bill. That's your hypothetical.
Yeah.
And the challenge that you're suggesting a claimant might make there is that there's a denial of equal privileges and immunities in the form of that claim.
Yes.
And then the question for the legislative, for the courts in examining that is the distinction between those two forms of equal harm on your hypothetical, is that distinction one that is made on the basis of a protected or as in that kind of loose language, suspect class like race, for example, or national origin? And I would suggest that there isn't a distinction drawn in your hypothetical on the basis of a protected class, because it's not, we're not saying that some kinds of political speech are protected and some kinds are not. What you're saying is that the legislature just hasn't solved all of the harms that it could have solved. And so the analysis for the court in your hypothetical would be, is there a rational basis for the court to solve the ADAD harm but not the telephone harm that leaves a message? And you might disagree, you know, you might reach different policy disagreements and positions on whether that's rational or not. The test the court would apply is, could a reasonable legislator conclude that it's enough to solve the ADAD harm and not go so far as to solve the other one? So a different kind of constitutional challenge is the one you're raising.
Yeah, interesting. Thank you, Mr. Shepherd. Thank all of you. What we're going to do is we'll probably move the bill next week. Mr. Brown, I'll work with you, but I need language from you. So I'm anticipating actually getting it from you rather than me giving it to you. Mr. Shepherd, I'll work with you and Senator Starr on modifying the particular penalties under unlawful trade for this particular piece of legislation, and then we'll bring it back next week, and I'll talk to Senator George too. That's an interesting point you brought up, so we'll chat about that and come back next week, because the sun is out, it's dinner time, and we'll close public hearing on 8:63, and we're adjourned. Thank you.